Mingling with matriarchs, storytelling, learning, laughing with Native women on unceded Musqueam territory. Warning, the following content contains powerful words by strong Native women that could literally knock your mocks off. Viewer discretion is advised. Salia Joseph, Queen Sna, Tanatinchla, Squahomish Nanemos Ohomeo, Alowin, Eoxowin, Isqualowin, Eo and Sequatal, Ehaichka, Musqueam, OCM. Hello, my name is Salia Joseph. I'm from the Squamish and Nanaimo Nations. My hands are up to the Musqueam Nation, whose beautiful unceded territory we are on today. So, welcome to Mingling with Matriarchs. Thank you so much for listening. This series is being created in conjunction with the First Nation Studies program here at UBC and CITR Radio. So this series specifically highlights the work of different Native women on campus who are doing awesome things and making space to tell their stories. But basically, it's just an excuse for me to interview these people that I just think are the coolest and so inspiring. In class, we talk about the ways that Indigenous women are represented in media and in the film world. We talk about the ways they're sexualized, turned into princesses, or painted as degenerate. Elmaya Tailfeathers is a Sami and Blackfoot filmmaker who decided to change these stories, to tell the stories that spoke to her and to her experiences. So in this interview, I wanted to understand how she went about making this space, the work that she does, and where it all started.
Samis ja Ganawas de blood reservatas. Yeah, mu achtila Bjarnastur Jakobsen ja mu Nila Esther Tailfeathers. Hi, I'm Elmaya of Biniskim Tailfeathers, but you can just call me Maya. I come from Sápmi, or the Sami territory in Scandinavia, in Norway, and I also come from Ghana, or Kainai, or the Blood Reserve, part of the Blackfoot Confederacy in Alberta.
Can you talk to me about your connection and your draw to film?
Growing up, my mother was a student most of the time. She started med school when I was 7 or 8 years old. So the theater was always kind of, I don't know, a place to escape or get away, and it was also cheap childcare for my mom, just to drop my brother and I off at the theater for an afternoon. I moved out to Vancouver probably 10 years ago, and I went to Vancouver Film School for acting. And, you know, before then, I thought really my only potential option for a career in film was acting, was in front of the camera, mainly because I didn't really know any Indigenous women who were filmmakers. I hadn't yet been exposed to that world. And so I guess it just didn't even occur to me that that was a possibility. Grew really frustrated with the film world. I mean, it's so limiting for numerous reasons. One, as a person of color, as a woman, especially as an Indigenous woman, the industry is very limiting. And I mean, we have this long history of sort of misappropriation or just appropriation of our stories. I just decided to go back to school. And so I came here to UBC and I did the First Nation Studies program. And I also did a minor in Women's and Gender Studies. It was during my time in the First Nation Studies program that I got my hands on a camera and editing software and learned how to use all of that. And I made this short documentary for Dori Nason's class about representations of Indigenous women in cinema. That experience was so incredibly rewarding. It was from that point on that I really knew that's what I wanted to do. It was also during that time that I was finally exposed to this wealth of beautiful Indigenous knowledge and storytellers.
Can you elaborate on that lack of agency was, or why being an Indigenous woman specifically is challenging in the industry?
I think there's two different worlds of film. One is this sort of mainstream corporate world of film, and then there's independent cinema. And what most of us see on television or go to our local movie theaters to see is part of that sort of mainstream industry. And that industry is obviously largely dominated by white men. And I think that's kind of, you know, enough said. When it's these men making the decisions and calling the shots, obviously there's going to be a large underrepresentation of Native voices within mainstream cinema.
What kind of difference then did you see after FNSP when you started to make your own films? How did existing in that world change for you?
Just a very empowering feeling of being able to tell the kind of stories that I wanted to tell and being in full control of the way that I wanted to be represented on screen. So definitely a major shift right. in agency.
Yeah. What were the stories that you wanted to tell?
Everything.
Yeah. Is there something that was sitting in you that felt couldn't be heard as an actor and it needed to come out through film?
I guess just so many social justice issues that Indigenous peoples live and experience every day that I wasn't seeing on television or I wasn't seeing in the movie theaters. Yeah, just being able to tell these stories that are so often marginalized or ignored, being able to create those kind of stories and be proud of the stories I was creating. But also, I wanted to make the kind of films that my communities could relate to, that my family could relate to, and that my family was proud of.
Why film? We've talked about what interested you about film. We've talked about you being drawn to acting, to that community, and then this representation, these stories that you're holding. Like, why was film the avenue to express them for you?
I've never actually been asked that question before. That's the first time anyone's ever asked. I really, really, really love film, to put it simply. As Indigenous peoples, we have always told stories. Oral tradition is so, so rich within our communities, and it's a beautiful way of disseminating knowledge. I think that I'm just doing something that's been done since time immemorial. Mm. I'm just using a different medium, mm-hmm. like you are with radio. And I guess it's a way to engage with people in a very sort of undirect, non-conversational sort of way. You don't have to sit down and talk about these things. You can go into a movie theater and be quiet and receive right. whatever is being shown on screen, and then afterwards hopefully engage in sometimes difficult conversations.
After FNSP, after Bloodland, what was the process of then deciding, okay, filmmaking is something I want to do? What have been some of the steps you've done to make that happen, to make it your career?
Well, I worked as a nanny for Cheryl Lightfoot, which was pretty amazing. I didn't obviously jump right into a career where it paid my bills and put a roof over my head and food in my belly. The next film I made after that was called A Red Girl's Reasoning, and I made that through a really exciting competition that happens every year in Vancouver called the Crazy Eights. And essentially, through a process of elimination, Crazy Eights film jury selects 6 winning teams, and then those teams are then given 8 days and $1,000 to make the short film idea that they've pitched to them. I was fortunate enough to have my idea chosen, and A Red Girl's Reasoning is kind of this action thriller about a young Indigenous woman who experiences sexual assault and then is let down by the justice system, and so she decides to take justice into her own hands. And I made that film because I'd just never really seen anything like it before, and I wanted to see something like that. That was the next step, and again, that was not paid. So I guess it's been a long process of being incredibly dedicated to creating projects, knowing that it wasn't going to put food on the table. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I've waited tables, I've been a nanny, but I've also done a lot of community work.
With A Red Girl's Reasoning, it covers sexual violence, which is a hard topic, and often it's Indigenous women that are called on to talk about these things over and over again, and that can be really trying on us as women to be the ones that are advocating for our own struggles, oftentimes alone. And in what ways is film make talking with these issues safe for you, telling these stories, and then at what point is it trying?
Well, I guess I'm just learning how to do that. And in making that film, I honestly didn't think about the reaction I was going to get, which is maybe, you know, my naivete, I guess, was a bonus at the time, because I didn't even think about it. I just wanted to make this film, and I made it. But you're right, it can be really, really exhausting. And obviously, when you're thinking about these greater issues of social justice, it's often the victim or the people who are marginalized and oppressed who have to speak out against the system. Mm-hmm. Obviously, a system that functions on disempowering groups of people is not going to change that relationship mm-hmm. on their own. They need to be called out on it. Mm-hmm. So obviously, it's going to be in the hands of Indigenous women to have to confront this violence. The violence within the film, for me, serves as a metaphor for the daily violence that Indigenous peoples have to live within this country. I mean, there's mm-hmm. systemic violence that never goes away. I intended to confront audiences with, you know, 10 minutes of mm-hmm. of movie violence in order to engage some sort of, you know, conversation or dialogue. And I didn't really think of myself or my safety. I guess because when you live with systemic violence every day, and when you're a survivor of sexual violence and, you know, sexual assault, you just sort of learn to fight back.
And how was the reception of the film?
For me, it was just so rewarding to have so many Native women approach mm-hmm. me afterwards and tell me that the film was a cathartic experience for them, and that they walked away feeling empowered. Mm. And not only Native women, just women who have survived sexual assault were approaching me and telling right. me that the film was a really powerful experience for them. So for me, knowing that it had that effect on people was kind of like medicine. Mm. It was mm-hmm. incentive for me to keep going.
Mm-hmm. Do you find a difference in the reception of your film when you're in predominantly Native audiences or non-Native audiences, or how do those conversations change?
Well, I notice a difference mm. every time. Mm-hmm. One is that Native audiences laugh
right.
at all the right moments, too. Not that there's a right moment yeah. to laugh, but there's moments where I'm like, all right, they yeah. get it, and I did the right thing.
Yeah.
And then there's moments with a completely non-Native audience where it's just like quiet, unsure of whether or not to laugh. But yeah, the types of conversations that happen are pretty similar across the board. And for the most part, I receive positive feedback about it. And often people do ask, all right, like why the violence in this mm. film? Why choose to depict violence on screen when the problem is violence itself? Mm. And again, a metaphor for the right. daily violence that Indigenous yeah. peoples have to face. Mm-hmm. So yeah, and I guess also one of the reasons I decided to make a genre film to tell the story as an action thriller and focus on the issue of violence against Native women was because I hoped that in making a genre film, I would attract a larger audience mm. and likely an audience who wasn't as familiar with the subject matter.
Can you talk to me about the ways that film and the conversation of violence have been utilized in an effective way?
Storytelling is something that should take you out of your body and bring you into an experience that you wouldn't necessarily be able just to have on your own. and film can do that. And with this film in particular, confronting audiences with this sort of violence, I really hope it provokes some sort of feeling of just empathy and mm. also just discomfort, just knowing that this is happening. The other thing too is I don't have the answers. I don't think
right.
any of us does, but we do know the issue exists and that there are so many ways that we can approach solving the problem. But the fact is that's not really happening. So in at least provoking a conversation about it, it's opening, you know, hopefully helping open more windows of opportunity for actually solving the problem and ending the violence.
Can you tell me about your most recent piece that has been circulating?
I have a short documentary called Bichtush, which translates into rebel in Sami. And It was commissioned by the Imaginative Film Festival. It was part of a project called the Embargo Collective. The Embargo Collective happened originally 6 years ago. They commissioned 7 Indigenous filmmakers from all over the world. At Imaginative in 2013, we workshopped for a few days, and we showed our previous body of work, and we talked about what inspired us as filmmakers and also what terrified us. Mm-hmm. It was also just a really supportive environment. There was a lot of laughter and definitely a lot of crying. We decided that we would just draw names from a hat, and then whoever's name you drew, you would have to make a film inspired by their work. So I drew Lisa Jackson's name, and Lisa is a close friend and mentor, and she's someone who's like my big sister in the industry. Like, she really has held my hand and guided me through some of this difficult terrain. So it was really terrifying when I drew her name, because it's like, oh man, like, this person whose work I love and admire and respect, I have to somehow try and, in a way, recreate with my own sort of vision. So the group challenged me to make a personal documentary in the vein of Lisa Jackson's filmmaking, but specifically they wanted me to make my own doc inspired by her first short film called Suckerfish, which was this beautiful, offbeat, poignant personal doc about her relationship with her mother, who had gone to residential school and, of course, lived her entire life dealing with the trauma of residential school. So, yeah, I made Bichtush with all of that in mind. And, yeah, it's touring the festival circuit right now.
Can you tell me about the film itself?
My mother is Blackfoot from Alberta, from the Blood Reserve, or Kaurna. And my father is Sami from Norway. And they met at a conference for the World Council of Indigenous Peoples back in 1981 in Australia. They were both in a bar, and the first thing my dad ever said to my mom was, "You're going to be my wife." and so they had this kind of epic love story, and that, I guess, set the bar for me for romance for the rest of my life. But the film is told in 3 acts. First act is narrated by a little girl in the Sami language, and it's animated, and it's this sort of really beautiful, playful interpretation of that love story and their meeting and how my brother and I came to be. And then the second act is narrated by a teenage girl in English. It's about the time in my parents' marriage when everything kind of came apart. We as a family were sort of faced with the issues my father was dealing with. And then the third act is narrated by myself, and I shot a lot of it myself over in Norway. And it's about the realizations I came to now as a woman, and having gone back to Sapmi and spent a lot of time with my dad, and finally understanding that a lot of the painful memories I carry of my upbringing really relate back to his experiences in the Sami boarding school system. So it's about that intergenerational trauma and how it is actually manifested within families, and how we actually carry that trauma and the very real ways that it affects relationships. So yeah, it was definitely a very challenging film to make. My family was always in the know about it, and they were supportive of it, which was really nice. Yeah, I had to consistently send them drafts and drafts of the script, so they were always aware of where I was taking the story, and they were the first ones to see the film. So I screened it for my mom and my extended family back home on the Blood Reserve, and then also shared it with my father before anybody else saw it. So it took courage for my family also to be okay with me telling this story, because it's all of our story, and it's different for each one of us. So and I think I'm still really healing from the experience of A, making the film, but also B, of having to revisit this history that I sort of put behind me, and revisit it in a very, I guess, a very critical, objective sort of way. You know, you close these doors behind you from the past, you don't intend to revisit them, and this kind of forced me to revisit my own history and why I am the way I am, and why the way, you know, why my father is the way he is, and why our relationship is the way it is. And also, I think it's helping me understand, I guess, in a more realistic way, how relationships work. But yeah, it's definitely also helped me, I guess, revisit my own sort of experiences with relationships and how I treat the people I love and vice versa.
How was the process of showing your mom and then your dad?
It was really terrifying.
Yeah.
I don't really get that nervous for screening my films, mm-hmm. but I was absolutely terrified. I flew home to Alberta before going to Toronto for Imaginative. We had a big family dinner, and my whole extended family was over, and my little cousins were running all over the house, and finally I had to screen the film for everyone because I kept asking, and I was kind of like, oh, maybe I should just put it off and not actually show them. But then they were like, so when are we going to see this film? So yeah, I was just sweating, just like nonstop sweating. I thought I was just going to puke everywhere. I screened it for them, and they ended up really, really loving it. So that was a huge weight off my shoulder. For my dad, he liked it, but I think it's going to be a very different experience for him, mm-hmm. especially when Sami audiences view the film, because it still hasn't been screened at the Sami festivals. The whole boarding school history there isn't as openly talked about as the residential school mm-hmm. history is here mm-hmm. in Canada. I'm really not sure how audiences are going to receive it. Mm. The other thing, too, is my father's he's a very public figure over there because of his work with activism and politics and journalism. And so it was really, really courageous of him to be okay with me telling the story, knowing that a lot of people who know him will see it. It's a very personal film, and you know, a lot of the things that happen with families behind closed doors stay private forever, you know, they stay within families.
How does it feel to have this one circulate? How is that for you?
It's really, really strange to have just so many strangers knowing this, you know, deeply personal mm-hmm. part of my story and my family's story. I mean, I guess with my previous films, they're personal in that I put all of my personal politics into the film, masked by fiction. But with this, it was just, I guess, a straight-up rehashing of the past.
So you have been involved in some other collaborative work involving new media. So can you tell me about what you're witnessing in Indigenous new media right now?
I think it was Leanne Simpson who coined the whole Indigenous art renaissance phrase, I guess. But yeah, I think we're witnessing something really, really incredible across Indian country, which is that we finally have access to this sort of technology, and we're hearing this massive wave of Indigenous voices and so many different experiences that it's providing a really, really rich, I guess, social fabric or understanding of Indigenous lived experiences today. And I'm so excited for, you know, 10 years down the road. And I guess I co-curated a show at MOA called Claiming Space, Voices of Urban Aboriginal Youth. And that was one of the most media-heavy, actually it was the most media-heavy show that MOA has ever had. We had over 15 film and video pieces, a lot of some digital media. And I guess what that says is that young people are gravitating towards new media. And maybe it's because it's actually a really inexpensive way of expression. It's an accessible art form. Yeah. And I definitely think it's shifting the way that the world sees us, and also in the way that we relate to each other. I mean, it's pretty amazing that there's multiple Indigenous podcasts that we can reach out to on any given day. It's really changing the way that we relate to each other and that the world relates to us.
Anything that you're working on now, or any work to expect from you?
I want to make a feature. That's the plan. Okay. I've written a couple drafts now of the feature-length version of A Red Girl's Reasoning, and hopefully we'll have a third draft done within the next few weeks. And then, yeah, I really, really want to turn this into a feature-length film. So that's the next step, is making a feature. And music videos. I really want to try music videos. I mean, there's so much out there, and there's always room for growth, and I feel like I'm really just learning who I am as a filmmaker and finding my ground in my sort of creative visual storytelling and finding my voice. So I think there's so much more out there to explore. And I'd also really like to go to grad school for film and do that, you know.
Yeah.
Maybe teach someday, I don't know. Yeah.
Okay, well, we'll all look out for her feature-length film, and maybe if my path is radio, then we'll have her back, and we'll interview her about her feature-length film.
Thank you. My hands are up to you, Maya. Thank you so much for being on the show. I once listened to Leanne Simpson, an Anishinaabe scholar and activist and artist, talk about the value in coming from a community of makers, from ones who bank relationships instead of capital. She talked about the honoring of makers in our community, and this captures what Maya does. I want to thank her for being on the show and sharing her stories with us. It is not easy to exist in an industry that is not designed for our voices. So I encourage you to look up her work. She discussed A Red Girl's Reasoning, her latest film, Rebel. So please look her up and support her work and tell all your friends. So Haichika Osiam for listening. I hope you enjoyed our conversation and that you learned a thing or two.